Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgan, your host for the show. The Wanapum Dam on the Columbia River hit the national news this week after a 2-inch underwater crack was found in a spillway pier. National experts on structures and engineering failures have been called in to lend their expertise. Anna King brings us perspective from people living downstream from the dam and those working on trying to solve the problem. That story coming up in about 5 minutes. NPR News headlines are next. Next, the time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgan. A situation on the Columbia River is rapidly unfolding with the damaged Wanapum Dam near Vantage in Grant County, Washington. PUD officials say even in a worst-case scenario, there would be no significant damage downstream, but teams of engineers are working to figure out what has gone wrong with part of Wanapum's spillway structure and how to best effect repairs. Correspondent Anna King spoke with some of the officials working on the problem and files this investigative report.
So the problem with Wanapum Dam is on a structure called the OG. That's a big piece of concrete that's anchored to the bottom of the river. It has a big curve on the top where the water flows over it. It's like a river speed bump. When the spillway gate is lifted, the water flows through from the upriver side of the dam to the downriver side of this OG. This is how dam operators let extra water through the dam that's not needed for power production. But the OG is cracked all the way across its upstream face, underwater. The dam operators and engineers aren't sure how deep the crack goes back into the massive concrete hump, but that's what they're trying to figure out.
Right now the main focus is that particular area, but we are going to do a complete and thorough evaluation of the entire structure before we're through.
That's Chuck Berry. He helps manage the dam for the Grant County Public Utility District. He says now that the crack appears to be stabilized, they can
identify exactly how deep, how wide, how far, location of any cracking. We just don't know all of that at this time.
Barry says there are three teams of engineers working on the dam: county engineers, a federal team, and an independent panel of experts from across the U.S. They don't have answers yet, and Barry wouldn't speculate on what could be. Still, what's troubling to experts on dams and concrete structures is the OG is not only cracked, it slipped a little. Rob Shogren is the technical director at a French-owned concrete company called Lafarge International. If it's big and it's concrete in the West, there's a good chance Shogren's worked on it or knows about it. He says cracks in concrete dams aren't unusual, but
the 2-inch thick crack can be significant. It just depends on where it is in the structure and how deep it goes and what caused it.
And what's caused the mighty crack in the Wanapum Dam is the big question. John Osteros is a disaster expert. He's actually a national guru on disasters. You might have heard of a couple of his past projects, Hurricane Katrina and the Oklahoma City bombing. He doesn't like the sound of what's happening at Wanapum.
We've certainly over history seen some fairly spectacular failures of dams. You know, there's an enormous amount of energy stored in the water behind a dam.
What troubles Osteros is that the dam failed with no clear cause, what disaster experts call a sunny day scenario.
But when things just fail in the normal course of events under loads and forces that we thought were within the safe region, then we have to be much more aggressive, much more thorough in our inspection to make sure that we fully understand the total picture.
Osteros says a good move right now would be to reduce the water between Wanapum Dam and the next dam downriver, Priest Rapids. That would create a space between the two dams for the extra water if Wanapum was to fail. I asked Grant County's Chuck Berry if that was happening. He didn't answer the question, but he argues that even if part of the dam was to fail,
it's not right that it will create a tidal wave downstream. That is not situation or scenario that would occur at all.
And he believes if the OG topples, the rest of the dam should remain in place. But here's the thing. When I asked about the contingency plan for what happens if the dam does bust, county officials say they have drills and plans, but they aren't sharing a lot of specifics. They're certainly not sharing them with Steve Allen. He's a major employer in the area and lives about 3 miles downstream from the dam. His farmhouse overlooks the Columbia River, and his 100-acre apple and cherry orchard rolls out below. His eyes betray his worry over the dam.
If it broke, if it actually came apart, and a lot of water came down through here, then my orchard would be severely affected. It's only maybe 10 or 15 feet above the water level. And so if a huge amount of water came into here, it would affect that. It would wipe out my orchard, probably.
Back at Ground Zero, the Wanapum Dam looks like it has on any normal day. There are a few orange traffic cones and signs, but that's it. Confidential sources within the federal government tell me that the last government review of the dam's overall safety found no significant findings. But the coming months could get complicated for dam engineers' band-aid efforts. Right now, the mighty Columbia River is at its low winter levels. But soon, spring snowmelt will swell the downstream river flows, and sensitive salmon runs will be making their way upstream. Downstream of the Wanapum Dam, I'm Anna King in Richland.
Also of concern to residents of the Lower Columbia region when it comes to many underground tanks filled with radioactive sludge at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, just how much do we know? U.S. Senator Ron Wyden says not enough. He's accusing the Department of Energy of not being forthright. He says the federal agency that manages the nuclear site held back a report that would have informed cleanup negotiations with Washington State. Correspondent Anna King spoke with Senator Wyden this week about the cleanup delays. She files this report.
On an icy Saturday morning, brave Portlanders are debarking school buses and jumping into the river for a polar plunge. Nearby, Wyden called his press conference at a boathouse on the river to highlight why cleanup at Hanford is so important. Just upstream near Richland, the radioactive waste tanks at Hanford are a few miles from these same icy waters.
This is right next to our lifeblood, the Columbia River, the river that we depend on for everything from recreation to jobs to quality of life. This feels like the longest-running battle since the Trojan War. It just goes on and on.
Wyden is talking about the ongoing effort to clean up underground tanks full of radioactive waste at Hanford. The site has been riddled with challenges, whistleblowers, missed deadlines, and aging, leaking tanks. And now the latest development. Wyden says the Department of Energy held back key documents from Washington State and lawmakers that would have informed negotiations on cleanup. So what's to clean up? 56 million gallons of radioactive waste in aging underground tanks. Most of these tanks have one hole, and many have leaked. 28 newer, supposedly stronger tanks were built later at Hanford. Wyden says these tanks were supposed to be part of the solution to empty the aging single-shell tanks. Now Wyden says this held-back government report says some of these newer tanks have construction problems, too. Wyden says the region needs new ideas to stabilize the situation. Are you saying new tanks because we can't figure out the rest of this mess?
I'm not saying new tanks this morning. I'm saying new tanks should be one of the options looked at.
But new tanks would be an expensive option, costing many millions of dollars for each new one. And top officials on the site and some politicians say building new underground waste tanks at Hanford would take focus off the end goal, treating the radioactive sludge. That plan involves binding up the sludge in massive glass logs in a huge factory being built at Hanford now. But that yet-to-be-completed treatment plant has many problems of its own. It has a complicated design that stalled major parts of the plant. Wyden says waiting any longer for completion of the treatment plant or a solution on these tanks is putting the Northwest at risk. The region could lose federal political support and, more importantly, cleanup money.
There's a big, big urgency in the sense that in tight budget times, we've got to show that we're producing. We've got to show that we're actually getting it cleaned up.
Tom Fletcher is with the Department of Energy in Richland. He says he's not sure why state decision makers didn't see the report on possible construction flaws on Hanford tanks. But he says the agency has a program that checks the tanks regularly for leaks and maintenance. Senator Wyden has asked the head of the Energy Department, Secretary Ernest Moniz, for a new plan on Hanford tanks in 45 days. Hanford was where the federal government produced plutonium for World War II and the Cold War. Now, it's one of the biggest cleanup efforts on the planet. I'm Anna King in Portland, Oregon.
Clatsop Community Action is marking its 25th anniversary as an Oregon nonprofit. George Sable, the organization's director, gave a status report to the Astoria City Council at their meeting on Tuesday. Sable said homelessness in Clatsop County continues to increase, reflecting the trend in the rest of the country. Each year in January, a local count is conducted. Sable shared the numbers with the council.
In 2001 to 2008, the amount of homeless people in our county was between 100 and 125 people. This past January, we went out, and this number is not final, but it's pretty close, 1,203 people. So that's the bad news. The economy has changed so much, and it has gone up every year. I'll just read quickly. 2009, 137. 2010, 184. 2011, 407. 12, 640. Last year, 1,038. This year, 1,200.
Sable said in 2010, the county began the Project Homeless Connect program, including a more organized annual homeless count. The more recent counts are the most accurate numbers reflecting the actual local homeless population. Sable then thanked the city for the $15,000 allocated for assistance for residents in need and explained where those dollars go.
We helped 395 households in Astoria. And this is the 97103 zip code, so that becomes a little confusing, too. It's not just city proper. 393 households with energy assistance spent over $78,000 on energy assistance. 54 households with rental assistance to help people pay their rent. That was $28,000. We have Hilltop Apartments up on top of the hill. We have 22 houses there of low-income housing. So we help out somewhere between, it depends, 54 to about 70 people up there in that housing. And we helped 231 people with wood, working with the, it's $20 a load for wood from the county sheriff's department.
Other services include prescription drug assistance, mail accounts for homeless people, low-income housing, and the recent addition of utility bill assistance for Astoria water customers. He said only three households have received help from that program so far and urged the council to alter requirements to make the program more accessible. Councilmember Drew Herzig, who originally advocated for the program, agreed.
That would be fine with me to lower the bar, actually, to make it not the cutoff notice, but the delinquent.
Yes, raise the bar
notice.
For income is what I'm saying. So we're saying the same thing. Raise the bar as far as the lowest income. I think we need to say let's raise it.
Sable said the regional food banks provide the most widely used service in the region.
We have 16 different programs inside Astoria, 13 different agencies that run food related programs that we support. So Clatsop Community Action, they're all separate nonprofits or under a nonprofit umbrella. They're the pantries, they're the Meals on Wheels, the senior center. They actually are the ones meeting the public, so to speak. We're the warehouse distribution center. We're helping get food to them. So even though they're a separate 501c3 nonprofit, they look to us to get additional help where we do the food drives, we get food cheaply through Oregon Food Bank, et cetera. And we do a lot of intentional production. If you haven't heard about that, Fish and Game works with us. When they seize animals and fish, we get it, we process it. We have a USDA processing license to do that. Over the last 2 years, we brought in about 50,000 pounds of fish and game through the food bank that went to people.
At the conclusion of Sable's report, City Council member Karen Malin expressed praise for the efforts of Clatsop Community Action, echoed by applause from the rest of the council and members of the public present.
It's amazing. I mean, this is big. The whole housing project, how you your gardens, how you know how to handle meat and
we're still
fish.
Working on bigger and better things. Hopefully you we're are with the city on something with housing right now. Brett and I are already planning ahead.
You're just terrific. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, Astoria's homeless population has doubled in recent years. Similar increases are happening nationwide. In Olympia, Washington, one project seeks to provide stability and safety so that individuals can focus on getting their lives together.
Being a female and being alone out there is really, really scary. I know I've done it, and that's not something I ever want to have to experience again.
Elizabeth Jenkins reports just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. A high wind warning is in effect until noon today. Otherwise, in today's forecast, showers, a chance of thunderstorms this morning, then a slight chance of thunderstorms this afternoon. Very windy. Southwest winds 30 to 40 miles per hour, gusting to 65 miles per hour, then decreasing this afternoon to 20 to 30 miles per hour with gusts to 45 miles per hour. Highs today around 55 degrees. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says the rain diminishes tonight and tomorrow as a brief period of high pressure moves across. Some of the models show another slow-moving moist system bringing periods of heavy rains once again into Sunday, maybe into Monday. In Olympia, Washington, housing advocates have established a new development where 30 residents are living day-to-day without having to seek daytime shelter elsewhere. Their new homes are part of a complex called Quixote Village, and as Elizabeth Jenkins reports, this unique approach to housing is providing a tiny local solution to the larger issue of homelessness.
Right now it's dinner time at Quixote Village, and the community center is teeming with activity. Residents scoop up forkfuls of meatloaf and mac and cheese. Everyone's spread out. They're washing dishes in the kitchen, fiddling with a laptop, swapping stories about their day. This is not a homeless shelter. Organizer Jill Severn says,
this is actually a home. This is classified as permanent supportive housing.
That means formerly homeless residents don't have to leave. They can live at Quixote Village for as long as they need a place to stay. A shelter requires that you're out in the morning. There's little stability, and sometimes it's difficult to get a bed the next night. Quixote Village offers more than a bed. It gives residents their own house, albeit a tiny one.
I mean, now that people are in housing, the world looks so different. From the day we moved in here, the conversation changed. People started talking about what they wanted to do with their lives, not just how to get through the day.
Quixote resident Rebecca Johnson shows me her house. There's a pitched roof, tiny porch, a light by the front door.
A little living room area, but I have it with my table and my computer on it. Twin size bed. Milk crates work great for bookshelves. Pictures of my kids that I actually get to hang up. I don't just have to have them in a plastic bag where they won't get wet. I actually get to have them.
And the size of the house is 144 square feet. One small bedroom and half bath.
About the size of a carport. Tents don't come this big.
Johnson is 34 years old. She's trying to get into treatment for drug and alcohol addiction. 2 years ago, she lost custody of her three kids, went to jail, and was evicted from her house. After becoming homeless, she slept inside a tent in the woods, alone.
Being a female and being alone out there is really, really scary. I know I've done it. that's not something I ever want to have to experience again.
Now her house backs up to a protective fence that encloses the village. Her belongings locked up with a key.
Once I got into a secure place, I didn't need to stay high every day. You know, I could finally go home and sleep and be at ease because I had a safe place. I didn't have to worry about staying awake, staying alive.
Residents collaborated on the village's design. Originally, the homes were laid out in clusters around the property for privacy, but they were concerned about cliques forming. So the architect created a horseshoe layout, the homes facing inward. Another design compromise was the front porch.
The residents gave up the living space so that they each had a porch to socialize out on. Come the summertime, everybody's probably going to be sitting out sunbathing on their porches, you know, having barbecues.
Quixote Village is on 12.7 acres of land that's leased from Thurston County for $1 a year. Surrounding the village, there's industry. Freight trucks marked Pepsi Cola are parked nearby. A swath of chain-link fence runs parallel to the road. It's not a location you'd expect to see a fleet of tiny houses. The village is located on the outskirts of town. The nearest bus stop is about a mile away. A community van is provided for running errands.
So sometimes here we find ourselves wandering around and going on board.
That's Jimmy Christensen. He says there are some disadvantages to living in an industrial zone, but occasionally, distance is a good thing.
For me, the downtown is the easy drugs, you know, so I remove myself from that environment, and it's not as easy to get high. I'm pretty much a homebody, so I don't want to leave home.
And when he does feel tempted to use drugs, he occupies his mind with playing bass guitar, working on computers, or walking the few feet it takes to reach his neighbor's doorstep.
It's just talking to her kind of veers my mind away from running downtown and finding a dose, you know. So, yeah, I think this environment definitely helps.
Even on the outskirts of town, Quixote Village faced legal opposition from its neighbors, nearby businesses and landowners, but a Superior Court judge eventually ruled in favor of the village. Funding to build Quixote came from state and county government. The total cost of the complex is a little over $3 million. 30% of residents' income goes toward rent. If their income is zero, they pay nothing. Rebecca Johnson, she isn't employed. She's working on sobriety, staying clean. These are requirements for living in the village. She says not everyone gets a house for Christmas.
Luckily, 30 of us did, because everybody deserves another chance and deserves to have some place to call home that's other than a tent.
Even though Johnson's home is tiny, she's filled with big future plans. A summer garden, neighborhood barbecues, visitation with her kids. Quixote Village is a place she hopes someday more people can call home. I'm Elizabeth Jenkins reporting.
Finally, on a somewhat lighter note, if you're a fan of TED Talks, listen up. The day after tomorrow, speakers on a variety of subjects are coming to Astoria to deliver a series of talks all in one day. Right now here in the studio, we have Cindy Price. She's the organizer for this weekend's Stand Up Stories. It will be taking place Saturday afternoon at 2 at the Astoria Events Center. There are going to be 10 speakers participating. And this is a great way for people maybe from out of the area to get to know our Lower Columbia coastal region, because we'll have local speakers plus regional speakers talking about issues that resonate here in our Lower Columbia community. How did you decide on 10 speakers for this event?
Well, it was really deciding on 10 issues and trying to narrow it down. We started with three issues that will be on the ballot in November: immigrant rights. This is access to a driver's license, marriage equality, and the right to organize. There are various anti-union initiatives that may be on the ballot in November. So we started with those three. And then where did we want to go from there? From there, we talked about what issues are of sort of immediate concern to particularly to Clatsop County residents and also to Oregon residents. And another is access to mental health services. It's just a tremendous crisis here in Clatsop County. Columbia River fishing, the sports fishers versus the gill netters, the governor's plan for that. Also, the governor's plan to reallocate state forestry revenues, which could have a devastating impact on Clatsop County. Education is a perennial issue. And then we wanted to have Beyonce, so we have to end things up. So we have Rex Zeke, who will be giving us a rousing speech. His is called "What One Man Can Do Slaying Giants." And on education, we were lucky enough to get Colleen Works. She's the 2011 Oregon Teacher of the Year. She's the assistant principal and a teacher at Corvallis High School, so she'll be coming from there. Bruce Buckmaster from Salmon for All on fishing. Bob Van Dyke, who's the forest policies manager at Wild Salmon Center in Portland, on forestry. Josh Marquis, who's our Clatsop County District Attorney on mental health. Of course, he sees most people at the very worst final end of their interaction with mental health, but he is very aware of the other issues that go on because of his interaction with families who have often spent years trying to get various services for people who then finally wind up in jail. And Senator Betsy Johnson will be kicking us off, as she always gives us a nice kick in the kick. And Sean Doyle, a young medics EMT, emergency medical technician, who was instrumental in recently having medics organized into the Steelworkers Union. So that'll be a fresh perspective. All of these are narrative stories, personal stories that are going to hopefully get people interested in learning more about these issues and actually get engaged in helping to make them better in our communities by just hearing these great personal stories.
So one afternoon, local politics, local economy, and local culture. And the recap again about where and when this is taking place.
It'll be at the Astoria Event Center. That's at 9th and Commercial in downtown Astoria. Doors open at 1:15. There'll be a few local organizations with some information if you want more about these particular issues. Speakers, Betsy Johnson will begin promptly at 2 o'clock. These are 15 minutes or less, the speech of their life. It's going to go really fast. You're going to be fabulously entertained.
And no charge.
And no charge, open to all.
Thank you very much, Cindy Price, for coming in today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's N-E-W-S, then the numeral 1, at kmun.org. I'm Kathleen Morgain saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.